From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
And although I insisted on keeping our show from getting to air at the time it should because I had to play some dumb YouTube songs, I'm still Ben. Hopefully you are still you. And today we are looking at something that touches on a lot of bases for things that we have covered in the past. So I figure maybe one of the best ways to start is I wanted to ask you guys, I don't know if we've ever talked about this on air. Did you ever want to be an astronaut when you grew up?
I watched a lot of Nickelodeon when I was a kid. And as you may or may not remember, a lot of those shows were sponsored by Space Camp. And, you know, that was the big grand prize. If you went on Double Dare, you got to go to Space Camp. And I think we all remember seeing the commercial where these kids were just floating, you know, weightless. And we're like, I want to go to there. Mm-hmm. That seems totally awesome. Spoiler alert. My roommate went to space camp. No such room. No such anti-gravity room.
You know who else went to space camp?
Who's that?
This guy.
Yeah?
Yeah, I was a young astronaut. I was fascinated by it. I went to a couple camps in, I think, Huntsville, Alabama is where they have a lot of that stuff.
Right.
And it was great. I mean, that was my dream, man. I was either going to be a marine biologist or an astronaut.
What did you think being an astronaut really meant? Though, did you have the concept of space scientist, or
yes,
were you thinking you were going to be like, you know, battling extraterrestrials?
No, I was hoping scientist. That was the track I wanted to be on.
I didn't mean to talk down to your younger self there.
That's okay.
Right.
He understands.
Yeah, I also, Noel, you know this. I also went to space camp.
Wait a minute. Everybody went to space camp except me.
Yeah.
So I think we should take you to space camp.
Right after we go to Dave and Buster's.
Look, I'm not joking about either of those, and I see your smirks from across the table. Ladies and gentlemen of the internet, my esteemed co-host, my close friends outside of work, think I'm joking about Dave and Buster's and the space program. I'm not joking about either of those. Visiting space-related stuff is so cool. And Noel, you are a meticulous person when it comes to your work ethic, and a lot of people might not know this because you're very relaxed and personable and chill when, you know, when we're hanging out, when we're talking.
I get riled up from time to time.
We do know what buttons you have.
You guys, there's an adult space camp in Huntsville, Alabama, and it is available and we can go.
Adult is in for grown-ups or adult is in like Showtime After Dark?
Maybe both, hopefully. It is, for a 4-day space camp, it's $600. That seems like a lot of money.
Do they cover the food?
I hope so.
All that freeze-dried ice cream.
Man cannot live on freeze-dried ice cream alone. But if you're like us, then you probably at some point when you were a kid thought of being an astronaut. How cool is it to go where no one has gone before? And even in adulthood, many of us retain this fascination with outer space, right?
We've seen the resurgence of this with the whole mission to Mars idea. All of the volunteers who are coming out from everywhere just saying, yeah, I'll do it.
And Elon Musk, the founder of PayPal and Tesla Motors, just declared recently, or reiterated again more definitively, that he aims to take some people to Mars. And who knows? Maybe one of us, whether listening or podcasting today, could be on that ship. What we know is that humanity has always been fascinated by space, and it's up there with the ocean as the least explored environment that we have encountered. We went, How Stuff Works went to NASA's Goddard Space Center several months back to check out the successor to the Hubble telescope, the James Webb telescope. And when we were there, we have videos that I'll go ahead and plug that you can find on the How Stuff Works YouTube channel, which is, you know, kind of neat. Full disclosure, I'm in a couple of them, the bad interviews. I'm the one doing the bad interviews.
Yeah, okay.
But then our our friend and maybe future guest host, right, Noel? Holly Fry?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is on there from Stuff You Missed in History Class. So you can learn more about the science of exploring space, at least the publicly acknowledged stuff. Today's question is a little bit different, but before we go into that, let's talk about some of the things we know about publicly acknowledged space exploration today. Like, first off, it's expensive.
Yeah, it's crazy expensive. In 2013, the cost of development and 5 years of operation was estimated to be $8.835 billion, with a B.
For the James Webb telescope.
For this telescope. Yeah,
the
one that you got to go look at. And when you were in there, it's this massive facility with people just working around the clock. Just, I mean, because not only do you have to build the thing, you have to test it so vigorously for years.
Because once it's up there, it's up there.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Right. And then there's a huge history of space exploration, right? The space race, you may have heard that term before, right? Cold War, USSR versus the United States, began in 1955, but it continues today and there are more people in the game.
Yeah. So as of 2015, there are an estimated 70 different state-sponsored space agencies. 13 of those have a known ability to launch vessels out into space.
Okay, that makes sense. So what we're saying there is that of those 70, the majority of the agencies don't themselves have the ability to launch their own thing. They partner with other agencies like NASA.
That is the idea.
So of those 13, though, only 6 have what's known as full launch capability.
And that means they can actually get back some of the things they shoot out to space, like recovering satellites, for example. I mean, it's not a one-and-done scenario where you put it out there and we're never going to see that guy again. They can actually deploy cryogenic rocket engines, and they can also operate probes remotely.
Yeah, so once it's out there in space, you've got a handle on how to make it work.
Or you can drop a vehicle remotely, right, to voyage around Mars.
Sure.
Yes, that's strange, though, when you think of the rate of attrition there. 70 different agencies, 13 can put something up, and 6 can do something effective with it.
Yeah, so 6 out of all the countries on Earth.
And we know, of course, that state-sponsored agencies are not the only ones in the game. Matt, you alluded to this earlier, right?
Oh, yes. Billionaires. Well, not just billionaires. A lot of billionaires, though, and their private corporations are getting into this whole space game. We saw, let's see, SpaceX. Mm-hmm. That's, again, founded by Elon Musk, like you mentioned. They just launched another satellite, the second in just a couple of weeks here. I think it was a Thai communications satellite. Previously, there was a Japanese satellite that went up. And the crazy thing about SpaceX is that they can, like you were saying, reusing the materials, they bring their entire rocket back down and land it somewhere.
It looks made up. It's like this vertical rocket coming down onto a little, like a drone boat or drone platform out in the middle of the ocean. It's bizarre.
Yeah.
It looks like someone played the clip in reverse of it launching. It's very strange. And I mean, all of this is so fascinating because we're entering a time now where, I mean, this in the past has been in the realm exclusively of big government agencies that have all of this budget for this stuff. And as we know, you know, focus on space exploration has kind of waxed and waned over the years a bit. And now it's kind of sitting squarely in the realm of these billionaires who are able to raise their own money, use their own capital to do their own research. And it seems like some of them are doing a pretty good job.
Well, the day we're recording this, Jeff Bezos's Blue Origin, another one, they just launched an unmanned aircraft, spacecraft. It's a prototype rocket that's apparently supposed to be reusable just like the other ones, and they again landed it back on Earth. So another company with another billionaire.
And Bezos is the emperor of Amazon, right?
Yes.
And those aren't the only private space flight or space tycoons. I can't call them space tycoons yet.
How about space-cateers?
Space-cateers. Perfect. Like Rocketeer?
Sure.
You don't seem as happy with
no,
that
I'm good
one
with that.
As
I'm good with that. No, no, no.
I like it.
All right. Who else is in this game?
Oh, you've got Virgin Galactic, another billionaire there, Bigelow Aerospace, X-Core Aerospace, Orbital Sciences. I mean, the list goes on. There's Arca. There are all kinds of other ones that are from different countries sometimes. A lot of these are based in the U.S., but they're all over the planet.
Right. And just being based in the U.S., of course, does not restrict their operations there. There are optimal places around the globe from which to launch something into space. So they travel widely. They're on a world tour. So given the lessons learned from the private entities and from the history of state-sponsored space agencies, we found some pretty interesting things about space travel. If you are interested in the idea of space travel, we'd also like you to check out How Stuff Works, other podcasts, I think almost everybody has something about space travel.
Absolutely.
Our friends over at Stuff Mom Never Told You have done some great work on female astronauts.
Mm-hmm. Just women in the aerospace industry in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it goes across the board. Every podcast we have has something about space.
Car Stuff has done a couple things, right?
Yeah. Yeah, as well. So we did lunar rovers.
Nice.
So what we found is that despite the evolution of space travel, there are still a few things that are true. And here they are, just across the board. I'll go first. It's terrifyingly easy for something to go wrong. Frighteningly easy. For example, the Challenger disaster. And that's just one that's in the public sphere. Mm-hmm. There are multiple classified accidents that occurred during the Soviet space programs. We've learned about a few of those cosmonauts. And we have done work before on the lost cosmonaut theories. And I think Jonathan Strickland from Tech Stuff has covered it, but definitely people died in training. And as we mentioned in an earlier podcast, were literally erased from history.
There's some fascinating stories within that topic. So I would encourage you to go check that out if you're listening to this.
So a big part, like what I was alluding to earlier, that makes this so difficult to do is that these voyages, this equipment, everything that goes into doing this stuff, incredibly prohibitively expensive. So the average cost of a manned space launch was estimated to be $450 million in 2011.
That's for a single launch.
Yeah.
And that's by NASA.
That's by NASA. And then the overall cost for a shuttle's 30-year lifespan. So if you're in it for the long haul, you're looking at a $196 billion tab.
Wow, and which is adjusted for inflation for right now.
But still, how is that a number?
Yeah.
That's amazing. But then there's a third thing here about every kind of space endeavor, which we were startled to find in some of our earlier work.
Yeah, how in the heck do you keep it a secret that you are using fuel, very loud, very bright fuel, to launch things up into and beyond the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm.
How do you keep that a secret?
And then how do you keep a satellite a secret and when it's orbiting the sky, which at this point is still uncensored? Today's question, ladies and gentlemen, do world governments and corporations have secret space programs? Given the cost, given how incredibly difficult it is, it's like, I'm going to try to make a video game reference. Tell me if I get it. It's like if there were Dark Souls 14. Does that work?
I think so. I mean, so it's a little different, but I'm going to go with you.
Dark Souls is the tough one, right?
Yeah, that's the tough one.
I'm so out of it. So out
well,
of it.
Well, yeah, because in a way, every time, if you really want to get into the space program, much like if you really want to get into Dark Souls, you basically have to take up the controller and attempt as many times as you possibly can, and you'll get things right as you go along, little by little by little by little. But ultimately, you can't just jump in and get the whole thing right. You can't just win by starting the space race.
I'm sorry that I gave you this albatross of a metaphor.
I'm trying to work with it.
No, let's just let it go. I apologize.
I guess what I'm saying is ultimately you end up throwing the controller against the wall. In both cases, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's familiar. The controller or the lander, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know for sure that secret space programs did exist historically. Mm-hmm. The origins of early space programs are shrouded in secret, began as research into rocketry and rockets. The idea of a rocket is ancient, dates all the way back to the first principles essential to rocket flight came from the writings of a Roman named Aulus Gellius, who told a story about a Greek guy named Archytas who lived in a city called Tarentum. This is now part of southern Italy. Somewhere around 400 BCE, according to this story, he made a pigeon out of wood and amused people by flying it using the principles of rocketry, the action reaction principle, which mm-hmm. wasn't a scientific law until the 17th century. The point is, maybe this metaphor is not, or this, excuse me, comparison is not that far off, because you are absolutely right about baby steps. So we know that people began working on rockets way before they thought about taking them to space. But we know that given the research of rocketry and the enormous jump it had during World War II, the foundations of the U.S. rocketry programs, the USSR, which was the big other agency mm-hmm. at the Cold War, and what ultimately became a space program, what ultimately led to atomic bombs, involved some shady stuff, in particular something known as Operation Paperclip.
Yes, that's when Nazi scientists and scientists from other non-allied countries were brought both to the United States, mm-hmm. to the United Kingdom, to other parts of the world, where they were secreted away. You know, these are people who were working on specialized projects sure. for, let's say, for bad people doing bad things.
Like Werner Braun, yeah.
Yeah.
Werner von Braun.
But they had an amazing amount of research and intelligence, and strategically, I guess it just made a lot of sense to keep them around. And just to jump on the rocketry programs that the world had, it was all about launching a missile or launching, you know, a bomb. How do I get this bomb all the way over here where I want it to explode and, you know, not have to take a ship over there or a plane mm-hmm. or something? Mm-hmm. That is why we have spaceflight. It's because we wanted to figure out how to more effectively bomb people from far away, which is kind of strange to think about. Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. government has a history of this as well. I mean, the CIA actually ran a secret satellite surveillance network. Another fun thing to say three times fast. from 59 to 1972, wherein they spied on the USSR and the People's Republic of China from, you guessed it, outer space. And this is a story I love so much because it just goes to show the scrappy nature of, you know, getting things done by the U.S. government. So the satellites didn't actually have the ability to transmit photographs remotely, you know, through the air.
Right. The 60s.
What's the fix there? Well, they actually had negatives and they would drop the negatives from space.
Space, yeah,
space. I'm picturing little parachutes. I mean, I don't even.
There are pictures. You can see pictures and even diagrams on, well, Wikipedia is where I found them, of the Corona. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the Corona program. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see just how old fashioned it looks and feels.
Yeah, I just can't imagine who do they send out? What poor sucker do they send out to find these things?
And where's the film adaptation of that?
Yeah.
I bet there's a classified script there still somewhere.
Must be.
Yeah, but they spent a lot of money on that as well. According to some former officials, the total estimated cost of the program was $850 million, which doesn't sound like that much compared to, you know, $450 for one launch, right?
But, you know, we're talking 1960s dollars when it was mostly in use.
Right. And, I don't know if they factored in, you know, like developing the film, developing the negatives.
They just got interns to do that.
Right, right. They just went to a photo mat.
Yeah. They had some guys at Fuji or something.
And they weren't the only ones doing it. And Corona was not the most widespread of these sorts of programs.
Oh yeah, the Russian side had their own thing. It was Zenit, I think. Mm-hmm. Zenit. I'm mm-hmm. not sure exactly how to pronounce it, mm-hmm. but they were doing photo reconnaissance in the same way. But they were doing it a lot more, I think. I think their program was a lot more extensive.
Yeah, they had over 500 Zenit satellites flown.
Jeez.
Which makes it, to this day, the most numerous type of satellite in the history of space exploration.
And this was all considered top secret.
Yeah.
Correct?
Oh, yeah. These were launched. Okay, so here's a weird anecdote that does apply to this. So we all know what a tank is, right? A tank in war. They're called tanks, the old story goes, because when they were being shipped around in England or around Europe to avoid prying eyes, they were crated and called water tanks. And so that became their nickname. Going to our earlier point about how difficult it would be to secretly launch something from space, these things, the Russians and the U.S. accepted that the other side would notice when they sent something into space. So they labeled them as different things or put them in different programs so that they seemed like they were accomplishing a different purpose.
Yep.
And as you said, Noel, yeah, these were probably above top secret level, some kind of compartmentalized need to know basis intelligence where, you know, imagine that you're the president of a country. And then some suit comes up to you, one of your advisors, and says, we have evidence that shows that we need to, you know, invade this country now or send a force here. You go, why? And they say, we can't tell you. And then you go, but I'm the president. And they say, I know, Mr. President. And
that's
then
too bad.
Eventually you're persuasive enough that somebody from, you know, the CIA or the NSA or some other alphabet agency just sort of slides a blurry photograph across the desk at you.
You're like, what?
And that's how you find out.
How'd you get focus on this?
So, yeah. How'd
oh,
you
wait,
get
wait.
Focus?
Ben, yeah, I have yeah. to say, oh, okay.
Yes.
The way these satellites look, the Zenit program satellites, you can, again, go on Wikipedia. You can look at a picture of one of these. It looks like a large sphere that has some optics kind of in glass pointing out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little, I don't know if in this picture that's being shown, if it's just sitting on a holder because it is a giant sphere. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the case. They just put the sphere down on a base. But I don't know if you guys remember the stories coming out a couple, maybe a month ago about the giant spheres found in Bosnia. This is complete tangent here.
Okay.
But giant spheres found in Bosnia.
Have you seen this?
There are supposedly these huge stone spheres, and this one guy found one, and he's claiming that it's all these different things, and there have been numerous explanations about what it is.
Uh-huh.
It looks exactly
like a Zenit,
satellite, one that maybe just ended up in Bosnia. I don't know.
That's interesting because you have to wonder what kind of a crazy game that is to play where they're like, well, the satellite's coming down. Agent Brown, you have to be at Kazakhstan in 12 hours.
Yeah, and how the heck do you get this giant sphere onto a like a flatbed truck or something? Oh, wow.
Very carefully, my friend. Very carefully.
And sadly, I don't know if you could make it to Kazakhstan in 12 hours from here.
Sadly, I don't have a truck, so.
Oh, we're just no luck here.
All right, so we're going to have to go out to one of our other operatives, which is weird because I just hate Darren.
He's been slipping.
Darren has been slipping. And if you are listening, Darren, you're fired.
Oh, sorry, Darren. Who lands the brakes?
Wow, we just made up Darren and fired him in the space of a few minutes. Okay, so we know that these programs existed, and these are just a few, just to show that multiple kinds of programs have existed. One of the first aims of this was to achieve supremacy in the space race, and the first from the first satellite launched by humankind, Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
The USSR and the US were trying to outdo each other and to get superior surveillance. Corona probably wouldn't have happened as soon as it did had a U-2 spy plane not been shot down earlier. And so they said, well, we'll just go higher in space where they can't reach us. And then immediately people began working on how to kill a satellite.
Yeah.
So the question is, can we, from this historical precedent, can we say that secret space programs continue today? Or was this just some Cold War thing?
I'm not sure, but we'll figure it out right after a quick break.
Here's where it gets crazy.
There are active secret space programs. Some of us know a little bit about them because they're little bits and pieces of details that get leaked or that are allowed to be discussed from a PR perspective. But the ins and outs of these programs, the actual processes that are occurring or what kind of research is being done with these, we won't know. Probably for 50 years, maybe 100 years, maybe never, until they're declassified. Mm-hmm. And we have several examples of these.
Yeah, one of the biggest examples would be something that is a personal off-the-air obsession for some of us in this room, and that is the infamous X-37B, which is an unmanned spacecraft that has been in orbit, as you check this show out, or as we record this at least, it's been in orbit for almost a year now on this stint. And what's it doing up there? Because I don't know.
Yeah, it was launched on the 20th of May of last year, 2015.
And that was its fourth flight.
Yeah, the fourth time it's been up there. It's still just going around, doing who knows what. Just hanging out, probably. I bet, you know, it's probably just a leisure cruise for the AI system. They're trying to get it used to what it will be like to be isolated in space, right? That's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal. I spoke with Jonathan about this yesterday because he was doing a live Facebook feed and he was talking about NASA a bit. And I mentioned the X-37B, and man, if he didn't just throw water so hard on my thoughts that, hey, maybe there's something, you know, weird being tested up there, some kind of surveillance program that's being used with this thing.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe checking the ability to somehow interfere with other satellites.
Mm-hmm. I just feel like that's a big thing to me. If people are putting money into these programs, there needs to be some sort of strategic advantage for doing it. And, you know, how better to have the upper hand, whether it's, you know, as a country, as a company, mm-hmm. let's say, than to be able to mess with other people's satellites, to be able to disrupt or have some sort of supremacy. Because like we said earlier, I mean, we don't police outer space in the same way that we police the skies, you know, of the world.
Well, yeah.
And, I mean, you know, so it's sort of fair game.
And we can't have any space wars. We have treaties. We're not allowed to have any kind of combat in space, at least from a legal perspective. No country is allowed to engage in battle up there.
Right. Oh, and I want to give a brief thank you to someone. I cannot remember who said this, but I was talking about either the Dead Hand system or something else in a live show, and I misspoke because I described the Strategic Defense Initiative, a.k.a. Star Wars program, mm-hmm. by Ronald Reagan's administration, and I wasn't clear enough, so I want to be clear now. As far as we know, it was not actually built. It was only proposed. So I do want to be emphatic about that. As far as we know, it was never built.
That's correct. Oh, and one last thing. We have to remember the X-37B is created by Boeing.
Yes.
And this is another thing to keep in mind when we're discussing private companies and governments and programs like NASA and the intersection between companies like this, where Northrop Grumman or Boeing or, you know, any of these other corporations, they get huge contracts from the government to build stuff like the X-37B. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you think about a government institution versus corporation, it's not always that binary.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It is often a false dichotomy. So what we're talking about now is the militarization of space. And you can see the, you can see the breadcrumbs begin to disappear in the post-Cold World War era. So one example of this would be that you are absolutely correct, Matt, when you say that there are international treaties restricting, mm-hmm. you know, restricting China, India, Japan, the U.S., and Russia from starting nuclear war in space. Hopefully that's the plan. But as far as listening in space, or yes. what's called a space sensing system, that is still, you know, that is still occurring. And one example of it would be the use of, well, they've evolved, right? They've evolved since Corona. Spy satellites now have stuff like high resolution photography, which is called image intelligence, or IMINT.
Yeah.
These are all weird acronyms. Communications eavesdropping, or SIGINT, signals intelligence, and covert communications, HUMINT.
Which is a weird one for me.
What GIF are Noel Brown and Ben Bolin texting each other today?
shrimp and white wine.
That was a great one.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Were you actually eating shrimp?
No, I was drinking white wine though.
Oh, okay. Well, it checks out. So, if we think about it, though, this kind of listening in, this sort of low Earth orbit eavesdropping, for lack of a better word, is necessary from a state perspective. Like, you want to know who's doing what.
Yeah, especially if you've got active enemies, people mm-hmm. who are looking to ensure your demise. It's mm-hmm. probably a good idea.
It also provides early warning of missile launches, detection of nuclear detonation. That's probably how in 1998, the great powers knew when India and Pakistan conducted nuclear tests.
Mm-hmm.
That also gives us to, you know, that's probably why they learned about the Vela incident
yeah.
so quickly.
We did an audio podcast on Vela incident?
I don't know if we did an audio podcast.
Okay.
The Vela incident is an alleged nuclear test. By alleged, I just mean we don't officially know who did it.
Do you think, though, that having these giant corporations like Amazon and SpaceX, I mean, I don't know, SpaceX isn't exactly a giant corporation, but Musk definitely represents, you know, an economic force in and of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a conflict of interest having these private individuals who are out, you know, to make profit enter into this sphere, you know?
Absolutely.
For me, it's always a conflict of interest when there's something good as the goal, but then profit is the overall motive.
Well, it's necessary. If we look at the history of human exploration and expansion, after the European way, like many of the great old civilizations, right, from African continent, ancient civilizations to, you know, the Middle Kingdom or China, they were expanding typically through some sort of quest for resources,
mm-hmm.
you know? So that applies, you know, to those European countries as well. My fear is that that we will be alive when the first manned off-world colony comes into existence, and that it'll be run by something much more like the Dutch East India Company than altruistic save the world or save the species kind of thing.
We're going to set up Mars banana plantations.
Ooh, maybe. Here's something creepy too. Another thing that these satellites are used for, of course, is GPS, which, listeners, let's be honest, you probably used somewhat recently.
GPS is the stuff, man. Mm-hmm. I think if any technology that exists today that didn't when I was a kid, mm-hmm. that is by far my favorite.
Yeah, it's a game changer for sure. I mean, in a lot of different scenarios, even if you're like me and can't find your way out of a paper bag,
yeah.
it's changed my life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The cost of maintaining that system, it's okay. So the system, the GPS system, and, you know, there are different ones, right? like India has the Indian Regional Navigational Satellite System, the Global Positioning System, that was originally designed, was designed by and is still controlled by, someone who will let anyone use it free of charge. Do you know who designed and controls it?
No.
I think you do.
No.
It's the U.S. Department of Defense.
Yay.
So, you know, same kind of like the Google strategy. Ask me anything. Free. All you know. Of course, yeah. That service is free. They're not going to give you a GPS phone or a satellite internet connection.
Not yet. That, I can imagine that being a thing, though, mm-hmm. in the future.
And so, it leads people to wonder what happens with this data, you know? And then there's the other idea that we just talked about, network-centric warfare. So using these communication abilities to essentially have clairvoyance, you know, to be the three of us were in a battle on one side or the other, then the people that had sent us there would want us to be able to know, like, oh, across the field, that Fredericksonian is prepping an electromagnetic disruptor or something, you know? And
he would.
He would. It's so Fredericksonian. And
sorry.
Right. And we know that we know that the things like the X-37, the unmanned aerial vehicles are reality.
Yeah.
Doubtlessly there are other countries attempting to do the same thing, if not doing it currently. And one more example of an active secret space program, which is happening now as we speak.
Yes.
So in early 2000s, both the US and China sent some pretty tense, barely veiled threats to each other. What did they do?
So in the early aughts, both the U.S. and China sent some pretty tense signals, let's say, to mm-hmm. each other, when they both publicly unveiled their satellite killing technology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. The idea of satellite killers.
Yeah.
But this was actually presented as an efficient way to dispose of their own aging satellites on both sides. And, they actually made pretty clear threats against each other.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a perfect veiled threat, right? Oh, our satellite is not functioning. Oh, look, we killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, you know, it's that whole under the table thing. It just shows you, well, you know, it could have been your satellite.
Yeah. Wink, wink. Right. Nudge, nudge.
And, you know, in 2008, there's another one called Operation Burnt Frost or Burn Frost. I think it's Burnt Frost. Mm-hmm. This was one where the U.S. military destroyed a non-functioning NRO, National Reconnaissance Office satellite.
Uh-huh.
Again, same kind of deal. Just like here, we're going to send this missile up and we can target a satellite in freaking space.
This is clearly an example of paying lip service to one thing and just saying this is a test of capabilities, but yeah. Everybody knew what the writing on the wall was.
Yeah. Here are my muscles, right? And my ability to shoot down satellites. Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's like someone saying, just casually saying, look at this knife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look how far I can throw it. And, these are just some examples of things that are proven, but remain to some degree classified, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where to now?
Well, now we get into the deep, dark areas, the places where light barely penetrates. We're in the fringe, you guys. You ready for this one? I'm just going to say one name. Gary McKinnon. Uh-oh, you know what we're talking about. We're talking about hacking NASA back in 2001, I think. 2002 is when he was actively hacking NASA, going through their databases. And this gentleman found, well, he declares that he found some pretty crazy stuff. I think early on in an interview that he gave to Wired News, just a couple years after he had done this, I believe it was 2006, he says, this is a quote, I knew that governments suppressed anti-gravity, UFO-related technologies, free energy, or what they call zero-point energy. This should not be hidden from the public when pensioners can't pay their bills. You know, okay, so this statement alone right here. So you've got a person who is personally motivated to go and find these things that he believes exist inside NASA servers somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He goes in and he thinks that he's found some of this stuff.
He claimed to find a manifest that described what were called non-terrestrial officers.
Yes.
And he claimed that he did see an image particular of a craft with technology that does not exist.
But he wasn't able to get that image to then show it to other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, it stinks because you want to believe, at any point you want to believe a person. At least this is Matt speaking for himself. I want to believe what someone says at all times, but it's very tough to take something like that. That's so out there, a claim that just kind of makes you roll your eyes a little bit, even if you want to believe it. What do you think, Noel?
It does come off as a bit of a stretch. And I agree. I mean, it's the nature of, I mean, you know, it's like a sticky, kind of a slippery slope, riding that line between skepticism and belief. And mm-hmm. you kind of have to just find a happy middle ground. And I think you do a fine job of that yourself, man.
Well, you know, one other thing, Ben, you have to remember this guy is on a 56K modem back in the early 2000s as right. he's going through these servers. And I'm imagining downloading the image, because you guys remember back then, as the sure. image comes down, it's going one or two lines at a time. And just, I imagine being Gary McKinnon and just seeing this image develop one line at a time. Of,
right.
What is this?
Yeah, it's weird because it gets into some technical stuff there, because he says that he got into Johnson Space Center's Building 8, that he remotely accessed the terminal there, and they found a folder that had these photographs that were 200 to 300 megabyte images. And the pictures were of cigar-shaped craft in orbit. But as you say, it was on a dial-up. Mm-hmm. So here's his quote: "I turned the color down to 4-bit and the screen resolution really, really low. And even then it was still juddering as it came onto the screen. But it was whatever came on was amazing and culmination of all my efforts. It was a picture of something that definitely wasn't man-made."
But again, he's looking at it at 4 bits of color with super low screen resolution just in order to see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the image is so degraded, then how can you ever tell what it actually is?
Well, he says he was able to take a screenshot.
Where's that? Can't find it. Looking for it right now.
Yeah. Looking for the screenshot.
I'm trying to find. I mean, I'm just saying. Again, a screenshot of a terrible picture.
I'll take that.
I agree.
I'll take a look at that.
His computer was seized by police during his first arrest in 2002. So people say, is the claim to have seen evidence of UFO cover-up credible? 4-bit is tough. And, you know, at that point, how would you know that was not an artist's rendition? How would you know that was the bona fide article?
Yeah, or just some ideas that are being thrown around. Like, imagine some of the meetings for development for shows and stuff like that we have here, but that's all internal. You know, it might be on one of our hard drives or even on a server or something. If we're, like, on our team, the video team, we'll make a sketch-up, a mock-up of what a show might look like or something like that.
Yeah.
And I can imagine someone at NASA or Goddard mocking up, well, hey, this is what a possible spacecraft could look like if we implemented these technologies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can see it.
Well, the part of the issue here is that he's still fighting extradition.
Mm-hmm.
He is in the UK, right? And he is fighting off Uncle Sam, who wants to extradite him to the U.S. And they're going to a lot of trouble to get him.
Oh, yeah.
They're going to, like, Assange level. Well, not Assange level.
No.
As soon as Assange is out of the embassy, he's just black-bagged, I'm sure. But what it, you know, I think it's such an interesting case, because he went in there not for some political or ideological end so much as he went in there because he believes that free energy is real, that the U.S. government has discovered it or has somehow created vehicles that can use it, and he wanted to prove it to the world. Obviously, he had a great combination of skill and luck when it comes to online espionage.
Well, yeah. I think it was all because he read a book that had come out around then about basic hacker codes, like not codes, but codes of conduct, that kind of thing, like how to view the philosophy of being a hacker. And he was inspired by it.
And you'll see so many people online or on the lecture circuit who insist that they have proof of secret space programs involving alien technology or extraterrestrials themselves.
And how cool. Just show me the money, guys, and the spacecraft.
Show me the saucer. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about this, though, is that in a way, we've talked about this in the past, in a way, many abduction stories or many working with alien stories have tropes that are similar to stories from earlier ages involving things like fairies or changelings or elves. And, you know, from a folkloric perspective, we have to ask ourselves, are these stories just echoes of earlier stories that have changed their clothes for our modern age?
Or the other way.
Yeah. Is it real and has it continue happening somehow without universally acknowledged proof? Here's a catchy thing about launching a space shuttle, launching a spacecraft satellite, an ICBM, like an intercontinental ballistic missile, which goes in suborbital flight. People will know, the average person will only really know if they're close enough to see it. The people who will know are the people who control the sensory equipment, and there are not a whole lot of those people. So if they all agree to keep something a secret, I'm not saying it's plausible, but I am saying that something can launch with fewer people knowing than you might expect.
And what if there is technology that doesn't require a launch like that with burning of fuel that could be detected in that way? What if the zero point energy thing is real, Ben, and it's in a hangar somewhere out in Groom Lake?
Then we would, if that's the case, then we would go to the economic argument of artificial scarcity, right? Like to maintain a status quo of social inequality and injustice, the powers that be, whatever those powers would be described as, are conspiring to prevent technological advancement past a certain threshold, which is interesting because I remember hearing years and years and years ago someone say that the Mayan and Aztec civilization was amazingly advanced, yet no one had invented the wheel, which seemed to me like utter bunk, you know? And I remember as a kid, I formed this entire conspiracy theory in my head. And I thought, yeah, every time somebody built a wheel, they were sacrificed or killed, or they ended up abandoned in the jungle or something because,
it was a profane idol of some sort.
I was like, the man was keeping him down. I have absolutely no proof whatsoever of that, or even if that story is real, because it still seems highly implausible to me. This is something that I just remember thinking of as a kid.
Well, let's talk about how this zero point energy idea came about. Because it for me, at least from my understanding, it traces its origins back to 1947 and the Roswell incident, when we thought there was an alien spacecraft of some sort, or a UFO that crash landed that used this type of technology that was then, you know, broken apart and re-engineered by let's say the U.S. military.
Yeah, that's the idea. I hate to be the party pooper in the bunch. I'm usually not this person, but it seems like a lot of the stuff we found looking into it indicates that it was part of Project Mogul, right? The weather balloons meant to sense nuclear detonation.
On everything that we looked at, you're right. That's what That's what I would lean towards as the reason that the Roswell crash happened.
But you're talking about the actual, the idea of free energy.
Yes. I'm just talking about the origins of this thought process of connecting the stuff together. Because aliens have fascinated humans for decades.
Centuries.
Yeah, absolutely. And as our technology has progressed, the way it's changed as we get into microchips, as we get into, transistors. I forget what the huge leap was in the, like around that time, 47, because there are some pretty interesting technological leaps that occurred right around that time. But, you know, is that coincidence? Is that just because our technology is at that point? Who's to say? Not me. I don't know.
And there's so many other, secret space programs that we could say are alleged to exist, like the Black Knight satellite, which we looked at in the past. The idea for extraterrestrials, the idea usually takes one of three tacks. Like, aliens exist and are in communication with some elite human-led organization. Mm-hmm. Or aliens crashed recently and some elite human organization took their stuff. Or aliens crashed in the distant past and the ruins were found and somehow humanity was able to put those back together. I think those all make for fascinating stories, and I would lose my mind if there was proof of it. I would be astonished.
I would be running in the streets around Ponce. The street that is Ponce.
You better look both ways.
I wouldn't care though. I'd be like, aliens!
But then you won't be around to see when they come down and, you know.
Yeah.
I don't care. I'd hit the greens on the corner.
Make their presentation.
Ooh, yeah.
Their PowerPoint.
Their PowerPoint. What if of all the technology that humanity has managed to MacGyver together on our time here, PowerPoint is the most impressive to aliens, not Prezi.
Wow. Bring up some Excel spreadsheets.
Not anything else about computers.
Yeah.
Just PowerPoint.
And clip art.
I bet they love clip art.
So what do we take away from all this, gents?
Well, what do you think, Noel? I think, and again, this is my opinion, I think it is foolish to assume that there are not programs, secret space programs taking place.
And I mean, you know, I keep harping on this privatization of space travel and what that could mean, but wouldn't it be possible that these companies have a forward-facing kind of public wing, and then maybe they've got some kind of skunk worksy stuff going on behind the scenes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, think about the money that goes into some of these corporations that are working directly with the government.
Yeah, and all the while everyone's like, rockets, look at that, that is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a big wow factor, but, you know, there could be other things going on that we don't know about.
We didn't even mention black budgets.
There's a lot
of dollars that
the government
don't exist.
Has so much secret money for all the people who are saying, I don't know, where's all that tax money going? A lot of it is secreted away because there have to be layers of plausible deniability so that your local representative or your senator doesn't know about it. Mm-hmm. And many times they genuinely do not.
And all that stuff would likely be militaristic in nature.
Much of it would be, yeah, dirty stuff. And then sometimes, you know, in the past, at least in the U.S. where we're recording this podcast, in the past, government agencies have gone rogue against the law and against the wishes of the rest of the government and waged illegal wars or assisted in drug trafficking to raise money for specific operations. And I'm not saying an entire agency went rogue. I'm just saying factions. So I think it could likely be military in nature. What disturbs me the most is the idea that somewhere above us, there might be a satellite with nuclear deployment capability. It's possible.
You're saying a nuclear weapon that could be just
In violation of all the treaties. Yeah. Or in violation of the mores, I should say, of international law. I think it is possible. I don't know if it's plausible. I have absolutely no proof for it.
Space death ray episode, maybe?
A space death ray episode. Not a bad idea.
Why, yeah, why would you not have a giant active laser up there just ready to go?
Well, as long as it's your giant active laser.
Right.
We're cool, right?
Right. That's the takeaway from today. So before we head out today, we have time for one more thing.
Yes, that's right. Shout out corner. And we have a guest theme today. I'm feeling a little bit put to shame by this. Wesley Slover did a musical tribute to the Shout Out Corner, and it is quite unsettling, and I kind of love it.
Yeah, it's well done. You can follow him at Sonos Sanctus on Twitter.
And if any of you want to put a little spin on the Shout Out Corner or make your own Shout Out Corner little jingle there, please send it to us, you know. We would love to play it and kind of show it off.
And next, shout out to Kian. Kian, you described yourself as an Irishman living in Minnesota. Ladies and gentlemen, Kian's recently discovered our show due to running injuries. We want to say thank you for the kind words. And we heard you want us to look into Virgin Mary appearances and other supposed miracles. You also suggested we dive deeper into alternative medicines, both the myths and the truths.
I like both of those.
Yeah, we haven't done much on miracles.
No, not at all. I don't think we have. We discussed some prophecies
involving the Catholic Church and stuff.
Nice. And the last shout out goes to someone that we've shouted at before. So you're welcome and sorry. Vaults of Xtoth. This fellow he makes metal music. He's a rapper. He's also a dad. He took some pictures for a new music project that he's got coming up, and he was wearing one of our Knowledge is Contagious shirts that we created and you can find on our website. I didn't know anyone bought any of those. So thanks, Vaults. And it's really cool to see you, because you should see this picture. He's got an awesome, looks like a leather jacket on. He's got such metal hair and facial hair, and they just got our shirt, man. Thanks for
awesome.
Wearing that.
Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for, giving it a try. We appreciate it. And that concludes today's shout out corner. And he did the reverse too,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Wow.
All right. So we are going to head out for today. We hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you will have something that you would like to tell our fellow listeners out there, then you can go ahead and write to us on Twitter or on Facebook. We're Conspiracy Stuff at both. But wait, as Billy Mays was wont to say, there's more.
If you don't want to do all the social media stuff, and trust us, we understand, guys, you can send us a message directly. You can send us an email. We are
conspiracy@howstuffworks.com.